TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Pakistan and its role in 9-1-1. Paul Thompson is best known for his 9-1-1 timeline, posted on his website, cooperativeresearch.org. And you are about to hear his talk about the role of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, in the events of 9-1-1. Why, for example, did the director of the ISI, Mahmoud Ahmed, give the order to send $100,000 to the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta? The Wall Street Journal reported this on October 10, 2001. The question remains unanswered. Why did the same Mahmoud Ahmed visit Washington, D.C. immediately preceding the World Trade Center attack? And you will hear in a moment who he had breakfast with at the very time the World Trade Center was hit. A Pakistani newspaper reported a day before 9-1-1 that Mahmoud Ahmed met with the CIA director, the Pentagon, and the National Security Council. Paul Thompson attended the International Inquiry into 9-1-1 in San Francisco in March of 2004. He presented the material on Pakistan and its role in 9-1-1 from his timeline. His research is considered very reliable and has been used by many writers, most recently by David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. Here is Paul Thompson.
Hi there. I just want to say something before I begin my talk on Pakistan and its role in 9-11. And that is, in my 9-11 timeline, I use only mainstream sources, New York Times, Newsweek, that kind of thing. And when I'm talking today, everything I'm going to be saying is all coming from these types of sources. And if you listen to what I say, you might wonder, if you're not familiar with this material, how come I've never heard of any of this stuff before? How come I've never seen these reports? And that's because this material often gets in the mainstream, but in B-17, you know, some sort of small mention in the back of the newspaper. And I wanted to mention an example from just a couple days ago in this whole Richard Clark information that's been coming out. One thing that came out of that was, it turns out that in the beginning of 1999, there was an attempt to kill Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And the attempt was foiled. They couldn't do it because it turns out that he was hunting with the royal family of the United Arab Emirates. And for a whole week, they were out with their falcons hunting in Afghanistan. And this, the fact that the royal family, there's a mention that we couldn't kill him because we would have killed half the royal family of the United Arab Emirates. The fact that they were meeting with bin Laden and sort of partying with bin Laden already after he's the number one terrorist in the world, after the African embassy bombings, this doesn't even really get a mention. It's just sort of, you know, just a little passing aside in the news reports. There's no questioning, what is this country that is one of our key allies in the Middle East, what are their leaders doing, you know, hanging out with the world's number one criminal? So we see things like this that do make it into the newspapers, but there's no commentary, there's sort of no follow-up. And another example of that, to sort of get onto the topic of Pakistan, I want to go also in 1999 to July. And there's a very interesting sting operation that the FBI and the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, was putting on at that point. They were trying to catch some arms dealers and some agents of the ISI, which is the Inter-Services Intelligence, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency. And so they were all at this restaurant within visual sight of the World Trade Center, and there was an informant named Randy Glass, and he was sitting with these ISI agents and arms dealers. And on all the nearby tables, you had FBI agents posing as other customers, and people were recording and videotaping all this for, you know, to later to catch these people. And there was one particular ISI agent who's named R.G. Abbas, and he pointed to the World Trade Center as they were eating and said, those towers are coming down, quote unquote, those towers are coming down. This is in 1999. And he repeated this on two other occasions later on to emphasize the point that he was aware that there was a plot to not just attack the World Trade Center, but to completely destroy the World Trade Center. And this has made it into the mainstream media, but not very widely. So we can see right there that there's clearly something going on with what the ISI knew about the plot and their role in the plot. And I would like to not only talk about Pakistan's role in the plot, but also what that tells us about the role of the U.S. government potentially in the plot in 9/11. Because if we go back to the Afghan war in the 1980s fighting against the Soviets, we find that the ISI back at that time, at the beginning of the war, they were just like any other intelligence agency. They were nothing special. But the CIA really started pumping them up. We were watching a film last night here at the conference where there was some congressman saying that they were given several $1 billion a year, the Mujahideen rebels, from the CIA, from the Saudis. Estimates range from $6 billion to $40 billion in the course of the war. And all that money went through the ISI, and they took out their corrupt slicing off of the top, and they became very fat and very rich on all that money. And not only that, but the ISI and the CIA also started working on promoting drugs and promoting the production and sale of opium, and which can be turned into heroin, in Afghanistan. I have a quote here from the Sydney Morning Herald. It says, quote, "Opium cultivation and heroin production in Pakistan's northern tribal belt and adjoining Afghanistan were a vital offshoot of the ISI-CIA cooperation. It succeeded in turning some of the Soviet troops into addicts. Heroin sales in Europe and the U.S., carried out through an elaborate web of deception, transport networks, couriers, and payoffs, offset the cost of the decade-long war in Afghanistan," unquote. So very openly, and the CIA doesn't even really try to hide this, that they openly promoted the sale of and the construction of a large transportation network of opium. Until this day, they continue to do this. We don't know what the CIA role in that is, if that's still going, but we know at least the ISI continues to do this. As a result, they have their own budget, very powerful. They're called a state within a state. They've kicked out the leaders of Pakistan. They're sometimes more powerful than the leaders of Pakistan. And they're also a very scary bunch, the ISI. They are staffed with Wahhabists, which you may have heard is the very extremist form of Islam coming from Saudi Arabia. The Wall Street Journal said, quote, "Despite their clean chins and pressed uniforms, the ISI men are as deeply fundamentalist as any bearded fanatic. The ISI created the Taliban as their own instrument and still supports it," unquote. Basically, there's a network between Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, and the Taliban. And those four countries really work together. And interestingly enough, many of you probably have heard of the BCCI scandal, the outlaw bank in the late 1980s. And these were the same countries that were very deeply involved in that scandal. And, for instance, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates royal family, who we find out later is going hunting with bin Laden, they had the majority stake in that bank, Pakistani-owned bank. And some of the people involved in this nexus of these countries that I'm talking about were very interesting figures. One is Khalid bin Mahfouz, who gave money, very key amount of money, when George Bush Jr. was just beginning in his attempts in running an oil business back in the 1980s. Khalid bin Mahfouz was 20% owner of BCCI, and he later on gave a whole bunch of money to bin Laden, so much so that about a couple years ago, the Saudi government actually had to put him under house arrest because his ties to bin Laden were so obvious. He's even married to bin Laden's sister. So there's these very interesting ties between these people and, you know, business ties and George Bush Jr. And I find this very fascinating, is that PBS Frontline, very mainstream source, They quote a French intelligence document which says that these same players from these same countries I mentioned, they were involved in the October surprise of 1980, successful attempt to put Bush and Reagan into power, and also in Iran-Contra, that there was money going from the Saudis to the Contras, and these same people who were taking part in that were people who later on would be big funders of al-Qaeda. So in the 1990s then, in the early 1990s, the ISI created the Taliban in Afghanistan pretty much from scratch. The Taliban didn't exist. They gave them money, weapons, everything, sort of pushed them over the border, and they put them into power after a tremendous amount of support behind them. And it's pretty much accepted by all the mainstream media that the Taliban were the complete puppets of the ISI. And in fact, in June 2001, so just a few months before 9/11, several American reporters who were visiting the Taliban and even visiting Mullah Omar, the head, they noted that everything the Taliban had, their gasoline, their weapons, their telephone, even bottled water, everything they had came from the ISI, came from Pakistan. They also noted that all this material was being funded by the United Arab Emirates and by Saudi Arabia. So we continue to see a nexus of these countries working together on a Wahhabist expansionist goal. And in fact, on 9/11, those three other countries that I mentioned were the only countries to officially recognize the Taliban, which makes sense because Taliban was really the puppet of these various governments. So for a very long time, to go on to a different sort of tangent, Pakistan has had a long-standing sort of Cold War with India over the province of Kashmir. And India has a much larger population, much bigger army. It's very difficult for Pakistan to compete with India over the issue of Kashmir. So what Pakistan has resorted to is they've resorted to terrorism as a method to sort of even up the battle, to have the Indian army defend against terrorists. You can have a small number of terrorists tie down a large number of soldiers. So what they did was they created a number of terrorist organizations which were technically independent, but in fact secretly run by the ISI, often headed by people who are ex-ISI, but very recently ex. So this was a way to get a certain level of plausible deniability over what they were doing in Kashmir. And now what I would argue is that just as the ISI used terrorist fronts to accomplish its goals in Kashmir, al-Qaeda is nothing more than a terrorist front for the ISI and for these other countries I mentioned in the international arena. And we can see a lot of evidence of this. The ties between the ISI and al-Qaeda are very deep. I've already mentioned how the Taliban, which everybody associates with Taliban and al-Qaeda, that those were puppets of the ISI. We see a lot of direct connections between these groups and al-Qaeda. For instance, it's been estimated by mainstream media that several rich Saudis, including Khalid bin Mahfouz, I mentioned earlier, gave $500 million to al-Qaeda in the 1990s. We talk about bin Laden having a fortune, but he couldn't have done nearly what he did if he didn't have a constant stream of revenue from the drugs that were being dealt with in Afghanistan and all the money that was coming from Saudi Arabia and his other supporters. And also, bin Laden personally could not have survived. Literally, he would have died if it wouldn't have been for ISI support, because bin Laden is a very sick individual, you could say in more ways than one, medically sick is what I mean. He has had for many years to rely on advanced medical equipment to survive. And in fact, CBS News had a very interesting story where they pointed out that the very day before 9/11, bin Laden was in a military hospital in Pakistan, and he was getting dialysis treatment guarded by the Pakistani military, completely surrounding the hospital and everything. This was just the latest of many trips he made to get medical help like this. So they were very close allies. In fact, all these training camps you may have heard of in Afghanistan, we talk about them being al-Qaeda training camps, but they're really just as much ISI training camps. When Clinton attacked them in 1998, he actually killed about 5 ISI leaders and about 20 ISI officers, and about 20 other ISI officials in that attack, because these training camps were being jointly run by Al-Qaeda and the ISI. It's virtually indistinguishable to see between the ISI, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda at this time. It's more of a semantic difference. If we go back to Randy Glass, who I mentioned is part of the sting operation with talking about destroying the World Trade Center, we can again see that here the ISI is buying materials, trying to buy Stinger missiles, trying to buy plutonium nuclear materials for bin Laden. And the sting operation ended in June 2001, and they tried to arrest some people. They didn't arrest the ISI agents, not surprisingly. The U.S. government did not. And Randy Glass was very concerned about some of this warning he'd gotten about the World Trade Center. So he started contacting people. He contacted his state senator. He contacted his national congressman. He contacted his national senator, and that was Bob Graham, a Democrat. He contacted others. This story has been covered a little bit by Dateline NBC, but unfortunately, it seems like not a lot of people have noticed that story. But fascinatingly, Bob Graham admitted that he was given this warning about the World Trade Center by Randy Glass before 9/11. He said, "I was aware of that warning and about a dozen others in the summer of 2001. Later on, he retracted that statement about a week later, but he did at one point admit to that. Ron Klein also admitted getting a similar warning and passing it on. He's the state senator, passing it on to U.S. intelligence agencies. So we see that the U.S. intelligence agencies were aware that the ISI was talking about destroying the World Trade Center. And then it gets real interesting. You have to keep your eye on Bob Graham, the senator, and also keep your eye on the director of the ISI, who's a person named Mahmoud Ahmed. And in May 2001, the CIA director, George Tenet, he went to Pakistan, and he met with President Musharraf, and he met with Mahmoud Ahmed. And then in the summer of 2001, the Crown Prince Abdullah, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, he secretly traveled to Afghanistan. He met with the Taliban and Mahmoud Ahmed. Then in late August, there's a report that the U.S. is in, quote, intense negotiations with the Pakistanis about bin Laden. Then at the end of August, we have Senator Bob Graham, Senator John Kyle, and Representative Porter Goss, who, by the way, is an ex-CIA agent. They travel to Pakistan. They meet with Musharraf. Things are kind of picking up. Events are picking up. Just a few days later, on September 4th, the ISI director, Mahmoud Ahmed, he comes to Washington, D.C., and he stays there all the way until 9/11. And just the day before 9/11, a Pakistani newspaper said that Mahmoud Ahmed has been having, quote, mysterious meetings with CIA Director George Tenet and those in the Pentagon and the National Security Council. And then it gets even more interesting. On the morning of 9/11, at the very time of the attacks, Mahmoud Ahmed is in Washington meeting with the same Bob Graham, John Kyle, and Porter Goss, who he'd met with in Pakistan a short time before. And they're discussing bin Laden, of all things, at the very moment the World Trade Center is hit. So Bob Graham, who's been given a warning that the ISI was wanting to attack the World Trade Center, he's sitting here with the head of the ISI when somebody comes in and hands him a note saying the World Trade Center has been hit by an airplane. So that's certainly interesting, I think, to say the least. Mahmoud Ahmed went back to Pakistan. Pakistan was greatly rewarded. You know, you'd think maybe they would try to arrest this guy, you know, and try to do something about the ISI. But in fact, they started giving Pakistanis all kinds of military aid, forgiving debts. And then we find out in a month later, there are news reports that come out. There's even a report in the Wall Street Journal that says that Mahmoud Ahmed personally ordered $100,000 to be sent to the head hijacker, Mohammed Atta, back when he was living in the U.S. So this was there's just not a whole lot of media coverage of this, but I said even the Wall Street Journal had a little story about this. So imagine here, we now know from this story, we have Bob Graham and other U.S. politicians sitting on the morning of 9/11 with one of the masterminds of 9/11 at the very time the attack happens. They're sitting just, you know, discussing things, having coffee with a guy who ordered $100,000 to go to Mohammed Atta. So I think that's certainly very curious, especially if we look at this long history between the CIA and the ISI that stretches back 20 years and involvement in, you know, like I said, October Surprise, Iran-Contra, these types of things. And now more recently, we're finding out that Pakistan is the same country that's been giving weapons of mass destruction, giving nuclear materials to North Korea, to Iraq, to Iran, to Libya, to just about anybody who wants it. And there's seemingly no reaction from the U.S. government about this. The head nuclear scientist who is giving all this material, he was just pardoned. And George Bush said he was okay with just the pardoning. Imagine if that was Iraq that was doing that. Because it's Pakistan, this seems to be, they're just allowed to do whatever they like. I'm kind of running out of time, but there's a lot of other evidence as well about just some really, really strange things that the ISI did and connections between them and the 9/11 plotters. For instance, we have very good evidence to believe that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the supposed mastermind of 9/11, that he was actually an ISI agent. Some of you may have heard of Robert Fisk. He's a very famous reporter. He's openly called Mohammed an ISI agent, as well as other experts. And we see that the Financial Times back in the early they note that back in the early 1990s that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was seen in photographs with the very elites of Pakistan. And they said that he must have, quote, felt confident with his ties to senior Pakistani Islamists whose power had been cemented within the ISI, unquote. So then we see also another guy, Saeed Sheikh. He's a very interesting character, and unfortunately I don't have time to go into everything about him. But he was a person who was so important that bin Laden himself called him, quote, his favorite son and symbolically adopted him. And so he's a very important figure in al-Qaeda. But at the same time, he's a very important figure in the ISI. And he later becomes famous for killing Daniel Pearl. And he's become known as the killer of Daniel Pearl. But in fact, before that, CNN reported back just before the story of Mahmoud Ahmed broke, just the day before it broke, they reported that Saeed Sheikh sent $100,000 to Mohammed Atta. And so then it was the next day that it was reported that he was actually doing that under the orders of the ISI general. And all of a sudden, the U.S. media lost interest in that story because all of a sudden it became a very scary story. But we see, so this Saeed Sheikh figure, we can see from his ties, we can start to learn exactly who was involved in the 9/11 plot in the ISI and really make a lot of connections. Another really interesting thing about Saeed Sheikh is that there's a reporter from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and this reporter claims to be an anonymous British intelligence source. In early 2002, this reporter reported, quote, "There are many in Musharraf's government who believe that Saeed Sheikh's power comes not from the ISI, but from his connections with our own CIA. The theory is that Saeed Sheikh was bought and paid for," unquote. We find that a lot of curious connections between some very important governments in the Middle East, Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, the Taliban, and we find these strange connections with the CIA. And then we find this, which I can't go into detail of, but extensive cover-up and rewarding of Pakistan. When you'd think that Pakistan would be punished, you know, why are we going after Iraq and attacking Iraq when we have all this evidence here of Pakistani involvement? And just another example, which I don't have much time to go into, Abu Zubaydah, who's one of the al-Qaeda leaders. There was a story a few months ago that when he was interrogated, he was captured by the U.S., he was interrogated by the U.S., he actually said, "I'm working for not only al-Qaeda, but for the Saudis and the Pakistanis, and here are some phone numbers of the head of the Pakistani Air Force and three important Saudi princes," and this came out in Time magazine and some other sources. So we continually to see these connections between these different countries and the 9/11 plot. And yet, we have this very strange behavior by the Bush administration. And so I would pose one of two possibilities to consider from all this information I've given you. One is either that the U.S. was directly involved with Pakistan and these other countries in the 9/11 plot and allowed it to happen or helped make it happen, or the U.S. government was completely taken for fools, and then afterwards they covered up their foolishness and have actually, instead of punished these countries and these actors, they've actually rewarded them. And I would argue that personally I favor the first, but I would argue that in either case, this is really treasonous behavior to deceive the American people in this way, to let the true perpetrators of 9/11 go free. And in either case, it should lead to impeachment of President Bush. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Thompson, best known for his 911 timeline, posted on his website, cooperativeresearch.org. That's cooperativeresearch.org. Paul Thompson spoke at the International Inquiry into 911 in San Francisco in March of 2004. This program is part of a 13-part series on unanswered questions of 911. In TUC Radio's next program, you will hear from the journalist Joyce Lynn. She did a background check on the National Commission on 911 that is holding hearings through the summer of 2004. Her talk is entitled "The Cover-Up Commission: How the Foxes Are Guarding the Chicken Coop." I hope you can find a pen to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Paul Thompson on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour tape or CD with Paul Thompson and Joyce Lynn by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.